all nurses to the nurses station.
Lawless country people, all real close family. Lately, some of my kinfolk don't get around too good, you see. When that doctor asked them, "Son, how'd you get in this condition?" They says, "Hey, sawbones, I'm just a carrying on an old family tradition." Wanna know, Doc, why do you think I got some pain in my joints from years of playing hard in this life that's too short? When that doctor asked me, "Son, how'd you get in this condition?" I says, "Hey, sawbones, I'm just a carrying on it all." Tell me all about it, Doc.
Hey, everybody. Dr. Ryan Sawbones Molly, and welcome to Hey Sawbones, My Story, My Passion. Again, I'm your host, and I'm an orthopedic surgeon, a business owner, entrepreneur, but most importantly, loving husband, father of three young, busy, active teenage boys. This is the first time I ever said teenage, but we've got two teenagers now. So, well, actually one, almost two. But anyways, this episode is a really fun one. I've been looking forward to this for quite a while. It's a gentleman that I formed a relationship with, I think about 5 years ago now. And a lot of you are going to know him. You're going to see his face, hear his voice. You're going to be like, "Hey, I know that guy. I trust that guy." And without further ado, it is the president of Marquette Savings Bank, Mr. John Dill. John.
How you doing, sir?
Hey, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me. Looking forward to it.
So as we start all these podcasts out, I always like to allow our guests to kind of understand who the guest is, where they're from, how they grew up, maybe that 30,000 foot view of you in a 2 to 3 minute, I know that's hard to do, 2 to 3 minute kind of snapshot. And then we're going to get more into the details as we go with the podcast.
Sure. So I'm a born and raised Erie individual. Grew up in a Catholic family. Two wonderful parents. Both are now deceased. But we are a close-knit family. I'm an identical twin. I always have to tell people that because they might see me out in public thinking that they're seeing me. And they might see Jerry.
But is Jerry in the area?
Jerry is in the area.
Wow.
And so if I left this room and Jerry came back in, you might not know. You might recognize me, doctor, but many people will not know that it's Jerry versus John.
Okay.
And but many people tell us by our spouses if we're out and about.
Oh, okay.
But I'm the youngest. I'm the youngest twin. My parents weren't expecting twins at the time. You go back nearly 62 years and the technology then. But I'm the youngest of five. And believe it or not, the oldest person in my family, my brother Tom, is 4 years and 2 weeks older than me. So my parents had five kids, four and under.
Wow. I'm trying to do the math here, and it doesn't seem to be working out. I know the gestational period for humans is 9 months. Yeah. But
I can give you the dates, but I mean, my sister Peggy, who's...
you can only do that with twins, right? Yeah, I don't think exactly. The math works out any other way.
Right. But my sister Peggy, she's 53 weeks older than me, and but my brother Tom, his birthday was on March 23rd, and my sister Peggy was March 30th, and my brother and I are April 6th, so... We're 53 weeks from my sister, and we're 4 years and 2 weeks from my brother Tom. And then my sister Katie's sprinkled in there. She's the second eldest. But my parents grew up. My father was very active in St. Patrick's Church. My mother is from Lawrence Park. And my father grew up in a family run manufacturing business that my grandfather had started many, many years ago. And nice, tight-knit family, always in Erie, and went to Blessed Sacrament and then St. George's, graduated from St. George's in 1977. Wow. Went on the Erie Cathedral Prep, 4 fun years of my life. And then I had the fortunate opportunity to go to St. Bonaventure University, where Bob Lanier went, and graduated with a BBA degree in accounting. And I came back to Erie and started my career.
Wow. So born, raised, are your siblings still in the area?
So everybody but my sister, Katie, she and her husband, Ron, live in Pittsburgh.
Okay. But still pretty darn close.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So you said Irish Catholic, right? So
my mother was, her last name's Nevin, and her married name's Nevin, and she's a McNamara.
Okay. Did who came over? Was it your dad, grandfather?
So you would have to go back a few generations. As a matter of fact, I actually started the whole heritage list study, you know, trying to figure
out. You do Ancestry.com? Or?
Yeah, I started that. And I'll go in spurts, and I said, I got to get back at it. But because I want to find more out about our family. But my parents... my grandfather, they came, but I don't know how far back it would go, but I'd like to know more. My mother passed away back in 2016, and she was sharp as a tack. And I remember my wife and I sitting in the ER with her, and we were talking just like you and I are talking about family and this person and that person. And it had me thinking, I said, boy, those are the conversations that you want to have when you're sitting around the kitchen table and you're writing this stuff down, you know? So, but long history, proud history. And I was fortunate growing up.
Yeah. Are you pretty close with your siblings still?
Yeah. Yeah. We stay in touch. You know, my two sisters, they don't have children. My brother, older brother, Tom, and my twin brother, Jerry, we have children, but everybody's been busy and active in their own careers. Naturally, I'm probably still closest to my twin brother, Jerry. His kids and my kids are a very similar age. Ironically, he has 2 girls and 1 boy. I have 2 girls and 1 boy. There's a lot of similarities between us as we've grown up in our lifetime.
What's Jerry do for a living?
So Jerry works for one of the plastic companies. Oh. It's called Havoco Technologies. The air vents in your ceiling and all that stuff, they make a plastic one, and he's been doing that for about 5 years. He had a long career at Zurn Industries before he left there and did a couple other things, but that most recently that's what he's doing.
Interesting. Yeah. And you've always been kind of in banking or?
Yes. You know, I tell people, I says, I graduated with an accounting degree, but banking found me. It's not like I went looking for banking, but I've been very fortunate throughout my career. I've enjoyed banking. Yeah. Banking has changed.
Well, I'm interested to dig into that. So as we talked a little bit before we started recording here, the format, right? So it's kind of a mutual interview. We do 6 questions. You'll ask me 3 business questions, then 3 personal questions, and then we're going to spin the tables. And quite frankly, I, and I'm sure my guests want to learn more about you because they're probably tired hearing about me because a lot of the questions are repeated. But I mean, I don't mind. It's, again, me telling a bit of my story. And that's the whole point of this podcast is being able to tell the stories of so many other really, really successful people in the area. So first and foremost, I just want to thank you for joining me. I know we talked about this. I didn't mean to put the pressure on you. I saw you out to dinner one night and I was like, hey, John, would you ever be willing to do this? And I didn't know if you were just being a nice guy and saying, sure, I'll do that. But here we are. So,
well, thank you for thinking of me and thank you for keeping the promise. I'm really happy to be
here. Our relationship, like I said, started 5 years ago and I've, you know, you meet a couple key people in your life and you're one of those very, very genuine, authentic people that I've learned to know and trust. And every time I spend time with you, whether it's on the golf course or You know, we've had a couple of dinners together. I've just always enjoyed and cherished that time.
Well, thank you. And I can tell you this, the feeling is mutual. And if you think back, Doc, we met, we were introduced during COVID. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the first opportunity we had to work together was really not in person. It was at a time where we don't have to rehash that. But where I'm going with this is that having got to know you over the phone and through interaction, through email and all that stuff, I could tell what kind of a person you were and you are. And one of the things about banking is in dealing with customers, one of the big C's, there's five C's, character speaks volumes to me. And your character speaks volumes to me. And so I think that's why we have a great relationship.
Yeah. Well, when we get into the personal questions, the professional questions with you, I'm going to ask for the other four C's. Okay. So I'm kind of I'm foreshadowing what one of my questions is.
You're going to challenge me. I'll have to think about them as we're talking, but gosh, you're stretching my memory.
Well, as we talked about before we recorded too, you get to veto one question, but
I won't veto it. I just,
you will become the first ever in history of Hey Sawbones, my story, my passion, to veto a question. So, but without further ado, why don't you lead off? Three business questions for me, then three personal.
So how did you decide to become an orthopedic surgeon?
Yeah, so I mean, I was always very good with my hands. I was always very good with creating things. My guidance counselor in high school was telling me, Ryan, you need to go to art school. You're so creative. You're so very artistic. I was a good painter. I was a good drawer. I did a lot of woodworking. I also happen to like science and math, and I was like, well, I'm not going to art school. I was very involved in athletics, so my goal wasn't to become an orthopedic surgeon. It was, I want to go to school. I want to become an athletic trainer so I can stay involved in athletics. And I had a cousin who was a chiropractor down in Meadville, Jeff Leary. And I was like, that seems really cool, right? Helping people with musculoskeletal complaints, issues, neck pain, back pain, joint problems. Because if I ever had an issue after a sporting event, I would just call cousin Jeff and he'd get me in, he'd do a treatment, and I'd come out feeling so much better. So that was kind of my goal. I went to Mercyhurst, was sports med, pre-med, but no intention whatsoever of going to med school. It was kind of the necessary prerequisites to get into chiropractic school. And lo and behold, again, a lot of my guests have heard this story before, but I don't think you ever have. And I never get tired of telling it because it's kind of my origin story of how I became who I am. And it was 2000. I started Mercyhurst in 1997. The year 2000, I was a junior. And one of my roommates, Greg Beato, and I, he was planning to go to medical school. And it was spring break. And I had an interview in Chicago for a chiropractic school that I had already been accepted to. So it's kind of weird. It was like more of an orientation / meet everybody. So I said, hey, Greg, do you want to go out there with me? I don't want to go by myself. He's like, yeah, it's spring break, right? You know, we're free. We're two guys. Let's go out there. Let's have fun. He goes, do you mind if we stop in East Lansing on the way? There's an osteopathic medical school I'd like to check out on the way. I said, it's spring break. We got a week. I have no problem doing that. It's a college town. It'll be fun. So we ended up stopping in East Lansing. There was a gentleman there. Again, a lot of people have heard this story, but his name is Dr. Gregory Coppola. He is now a very well-known physician here in the Erie area. He was a primary care sports med doc, not an orthopedic surgeon, that was training, doing his fellowship at Michigan State at the time. Greg had heard about him through his sister, some connections. They had been talking. So we go there, and Greg Beato and I, we travel there. But Greg Coppola and I really connected when I got there. And we went out. We all had a beer. And he was just like, you know, him and Greg already had their connection and their conversations. But he said to me, he's like, Ryan, why do you want to be a chiropractor? And have you ever thought about osteopathic medical school? I said, I don't know anything about osteopathic medicine at all. I said, I know Greg's doing that, but I'm going to chiropractic school. And he started talking to me, and he literally, within that one conversation, that one evening together, shifted my career focus. And when I walked out of that, we were at a bar. When I walked out of that bar, I was like, that is what I want to do. I want to be like him. So I still went to Chicago. I still completed my orientation / interview, but my career trajectory changed. I went home. I got very focused. I had to take the MCATs. Here's the quick version. I ended up getting accepted to LECOM, completed my time there. And then, you know, I wanted to be a Greg Coppola, but I didn't want to be, I didn't know anything about orthopedic surgery. It wasn't on my radar. I wanted to be a primary care doctor that focused in sports medicine, right? Kind of my athletic training background. And then we had in med school to do rotations with different types of medicine, ER, pediatrics, primary care, surgery. So I said, well, surgery, I don't want to do general surgery. Like, I'll do an orthopedic rotation. It makes sense for if I'm going to be a team physician, I can see some of the surgeries that they do. And the first surgery I walked into was a hip replacement. And it was like the lights just went off. And I was like, holy crap. This is me. I've always been very, very good with my hands. I've always been very artistic, but I've always been very good at building things, constructing things, working with power tools, building furniture. And that was it. And it was like going to your father and telling your dad, hey, I don't want to do what you do. And so I had to go to Dr. Coppola, and I was like scared, like I was going to let him down when I said, I know I don't want to be a primary care doctor. I want to be an orthopedic surgeon. And I hope you're okay with that. Like, I needed his approval, and he was so gracious. And by the way, I had finished his basement with my brother-in-law. So he knew my talents, my skills. I had painted a slate with his house on it. So he knew my artistic abilities too. And he's like, Ryan, that's what you were put on this planet to do. So he was probably my biggest supporter, and the rest is history.
So this doesn't count as one of my three business questions, but would you find a lot of orthopedic surgeons do have that artistic talent?
I would say that's not as common as former athlete. Like, the biggest stereotype with an orthopedic surgeon is they were a previous athlete or they had a previous injury as an athlete. Right. And they had their ACL reconstructed and they got very intrigued with rehab and the surgical approach. But yeah, the woodworking artistic ability is probably like another trait that you'll see. But it's typically the athlete or an athlete that had a previous injury.
So my second business question relates more towards your education. I have a son-in-law who's a doctor, and I always view them as these individuals being very, very, very smart, very driven. As you were going through...
Boy, do we have the wool pulled over your eyes.
As you were going through your studies, was it a challenge for you, or did things come easy for you?
I've never been asked that question, so this is a good one. So I have three older sisters. And my parents, my three older sisters would say all the time, and I knew this at the time, they had to work really, really hard with school. I was pretty blessed with, in high school, elementary school, high school, I never had homework. I just did it in homeroom. I called homeroom where you do homework.
Sure.
So that came easy to me. Now, obviously, as you get to that next level, it becomes more challenging. But even in college, I was that, all right, I've got a test in 2 weeks. I'll worry about it in 1 week and 6 days or 5 days. And I was that guy that could just memorize, right? And I knew what I needed to know for the test, but I maybe wouldn't retain it for very long. And then you go to that next level, medical school. And that is when I started to turn more into a student. It took me time to mature. And it wasn't when I really became a student, but I became more of a student. I joke all the time. Wegmans up on Peach Street is where I got my medical school education. Yeah, I went to LECOM, but I would go to Wegmans because our tests were always on a Monday. And I would go to Wegmans on... So we take a test on Monday. Tuesday night, my friends and I, we'd always go out and celebrate because it was... Or Monday night because our tests were done. And then we go to Tuesday. We do Monday at Plymouth, Tuesday at Calamari's. It was almost like college. And then Wednesday, we're starting to slow down a little bit. Thursday, we're starting to study. Friday, we're really studying after classes. And then Saturday and Sunday, I was at Wegmans probably 20 to 25 hours on the weekend. I would go there. I'd be there for breakfast, lunch, dinner. Sunday, same thing. And I come in on Monday. And then when I really got into my zone of studying, though, was orthopedics. And when I got into orthopedics, my orthopedic residency director, there was two of us, myself and my co-resident. He was extremely intelligent. And my residency director told me on day one, he goes, Ryan, Tyler, he's the show horse. Ryan, you're the workhorse. He's super smart. You're pretty smart, but he's really smart. He's like, he's gonna dominate everything. You just got to work your butt off. And I was like, I was pissed. Right? That was all I needed. That motivated me. And each year I ramped it up. And I'm not bragging with this. This isn't a statement of arrogance, but it's a proud moment because all said and done, at the end of my last year, fifth year of residency, I scored number one, not in our residency, in the nation for our in-training exam. And number one, or I'm sorry, not on our in-training exam, on our boards, on our boards. Top 5% on our in-training exam, but our boards, the country, the whole country, number one. And when I got the results, I remember opening it. I was like, I know I'm intelligent, but like, holy crap. I'm reading it. I'm like, one, did they forget a zero or something here? Like maybe 10th or 100th. And my wife was like, Ryan, you did it. Cause I worked my butt off. I became that workhorse that was relentless. And when I found my passion, which was orthopedics, I was insatiable. I was just like, I'm eating this stuff up. It made so much sense to me. But you know, undergrad, you're taking classes cause you have to take them. But when you're in orthopedics, this is the meat and potatoes that like serves my soul.
As they say, do something that you love, then it's not like you're working.
You never work a day of your life, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So my third question for you is, and throughout my banking career, I was 100% of the time dealing with businesses, and I was always intrigued by the advancement in technology. You know, take this CMC machine that could do this, and now it does five things. You know, now that it's even more and more automated, and the output is unbelievable. The times, everything is just great. What kind of, and I know there's been advancement in technology, but what has been the most surprising advancement that has helped you in your career to serve your patients?
Oh, so that's a tough question, not because there hasn't been a lot of technological advancements, but I'm a pretty old-fashioned surgeon, okay? So there's a lot of surgeons today that are even older than me that are using robotics, right, to do hip or knee replacements or whatever their specialty is. I'm a mechanical instrumentation guy, right? It doesn't mean that I don't think that they have purpose or value or advantages in some way, shape, or form. But I'm kind of that guy that's like Michelangelo's painting the roof of the Sistine Chapel, right? The Romans are building aqueducts. The Egyptians are building pyramids. They didn't have robots. They didn't have this or that. They had levels and things like that. But that's, to me, this is where my artistic side comes through. And I'm a scientist, but I'm an artistic scientist. So it's not, again, that I'm never using technology, but I'm not the guy that's banking my career on it or using it to promote my practice. Whereas a lot of surgeons are saying, hey, I do robotic total knee surgery. I'm very proud to say I don't do robotic knee surgery because I feel like I can do manual instrumentation total knee replacement surgery as accurate, if not more accurate, than you can with a robot. And the studies have shown that there's no clinical benefit. There's no superiority with a robot versus manual instrumentation. But there's other things that I like technology for. So one of the things that I've used recently, and this is more for the patient experience and for education than it is for like surgical outcomes. This is very simple, but the Meta Ray-Ban glasses. I'm all about teaching what I do and showing what I do to others so that they can learn like the techniques. So I've never been able to fully get the perspective of what I do from my eyes, right? I've had multiple surgeries filmed, cameras up here, cameras here. They can't quite get the angle. And I'm looking at them like, God, that's not what I'm seeing. And it was frustrating to me until about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago, when I discovered these glasses. And I've been using them now where I can actually record what I do. And they're literally on my eyes. And there's cameras right here. So they see and they hear. I'm talking as I'm doing this. The audio is great. The visual is great. It's my kind of technology adoption. There's other things, though, and things that we're rolling out, like applications on your phone. We are creating an application right now that is going to guide a patient through their entire journey of a joint replacement. And it's a year-long journey, right? From day one, you come in, you're miserable, you can't walk, you can't play golf, you can't play with your grandkids, whatever it may be that you can't do that you enjoy doing, to the day when you walk out of our office, kind of ring that recovery bell and say, I'm good. Now I've done all these steps and I've accomplished that goal that I set out to do a year ago. Now, granted, they're way better than that 6 weeks after surgery. It doesn't take a full year for that, but year is usually what we kind of say is that moment of you're as good as you're going to get. So I guess that's my embrace of technology at this point.
Impressive.
Yeah. Personal stuff?
So I asked you the personal. I don't know if you asked me the business first.
I'm gonna focus all on you at the tail end of this.
Oh, great. Thank you. Well, you said earlier about your family, and it may even be been before the cameras were rolling. And I follow you on LinkedIn and I see all the stuff that you're doing. It's clear that your family is your number one priority and something that you're most proud of. What is your vision for your family if you were to look out?
Ooh, this is usually when I get a little emotional, right? Like I could talk about orthopedics all day, but when the family comes into it, because that is true legacy to me. We can have a stamp on our career of like what we meant to the people around us, to our patients, to our clients, to our customers, to our siblings, to our parents. But we've created human beings. You've created human beings, you and your wife. And they are literally offspring of us and they're representatives of us. And they will tell our stories when we're no longer here better than anyone else because they've seen what goes into this. So what is so important to me about this journey with the boys is, number one, when I come home, I'm dad. I'm not Dr. Molly anymore, right? So I have a very clear separation of work and personal life. And it's been designed in such a way where, you know, when we first moved here from Detroit in 2015, we intentionally moved to Erie, knowing that I was going to, at that time, work in Meadville. And now I work even further away, hour and 15 minutes, you know, Edgewood. Most people would like shudder at the fact of having a 1 hour and 15 commute one way. To me, it's almost a blessing because to me, it allows me to have my time in the morning where I can do an audiobook, I could do a podcast, and on the way home, I can take care of business calls. I call all my patients for the next day for surgeries. And then when I come home, doesn't mean that I'm done working, but I'm present, right? Like I may have a little, I got to do this real quick, but when I come home, I'm at the boys' practices. I'm this past November, December, January, and February, I was coaching my sixth grader for basketball, which was six, sometimes 7 days a week of basketball. Wow. I was coaching our youngest, Luca, on the weekends for basketball. So it was a lot. But We get one go round of this, and I do care. I very much care what my patients think of me. I very much care what my staff thinks of me. I very much care what my family thinks of me. But what I care most about is what my core family think about me, right? My wife and our three boys. So I need to set a living, breathing example of someone that lived with passion, someone that lived with conviction, someone that lived with I'm not going to ever back down to a challenge. I'm never or ever going to give up. When the road gets rough, when the obstacles come flying, it gets frustrating. You want to throw in the towel. But like, honestly, that's when I think the best of me comes out, because I'm a really good problem solver and it may get frustrating at times. But like, that's when I dig deep and I'm just like, all right, we're getting into the weeds here and this is where I'm comfortable. Like, and so that's the legacy that I want to be able to create for my boys, where they can say, Dad loved us first and foremost, right? Mom loved us first and foremost, but that guy was one hard ass son of a bitch when it came to his passion, his purpose in life of taking care of his patients and putting them first and foremost and never taking a day off. And even when he was tired, even when he was sick, I mean, I think in 20 years, I've missed 3, maybe 4 days of work. That was it. It's not like a badge of courage that I wear, but it's just like, I just tell my boys that. It's like, guys, it's not an option, right? Like I there's a lot of days when I don't feel up to it and I just go to work. So I need to set a good example for them and just be that kind of beacon for them so that they can be successful. And at the end of the day, I just want them to realize that like, you'll get out of life what you put into it. And if you want to be mediocre, that's fine. It's just not how I'm built or wired.
You know, a lot of people, I'll be out and about, and as you know, as we get older, people talk about their ailments and this person had this surgery, this person had that surgery. And I can tell you this, doctor, I'm in a lot of conversations with people that recently had a knee or a hip replacement, and they'll say, Dr. Molly did it. And they don't know the business relationship that you and I have.
Do you ever share it with them?
No, I tend to try to keep that quiet. You know, somebody asks me, I will tell them, but yeah. I don't openly share that because, you know, the business client confidentiality, yeah. I'm sensitive to that.
Sure.
You know? But the compliments and the comments I get about Dr. Molly, it's like, you're doing great things because people just love you, you know, and
it's the team. Right. And I appreciate that. That moves my heart, my soul, but I couldn't do what I do without an amazing group at Whole Health and an amazing group at Edgewood. I mean, we're talking top notch. I'm a one spoke in that wheel. I'm the captain of that ship, but I cannot do what I do on a daily basis without those great people. And like what you do,
yeah.
Right? I mean, absolutely. You're the captain of your ship. You are. Absolutely. No questions about it. But you have an amazing support group around you that make that whole process work.
So my second personal question is, you know, it's career aspirations. You can say, you know, what you want to do, but when you go to retire, you want to do what?
Number one, I don't think I'll ever retire, right? Like I'm always going to be involved in something, whether it's business, whether it's entrepreneurial, you know, things, whether it's, what I really want to do, I want to build furniture. I want to work in my workshop. I want to build furniture. I want to use the skills that I've used during my career of precision, of my artistic abilities to design and create. I love creating stuff. Absolutely love creating stuff. It's just like what gives me that like, oh, like I get a high from that. And if I'm creating a protocol, if I'm creating a program, if I'm creating a piece of furniture, if I'm creating a piece of art, if I'm creating a knee for somebody, because people would say, well, that's not really creating. No, it is to me, because not every knee is the same. Not every hip is the same. And quite frankly, every knee is different, every hip is different. And the way that I do my surgeries are so personalized that like I'm looking at just the very, very subtle curves of this person's top of their femur, like a lady today. And I'm like, all right, she's got a very bowed femur at the top of her femoral neck. And I'm going to match that with the anatomy of my stem. So I'm not going to put that in like I would for this patient where it's going to be more straight. And then I do a knee and this guy today, his kneecap was really off to the side. So I'm like, I said to my PA, Jake, I said, this is going to be a challenge. His kneecap's off to the side. Those are always really tricky cases. So I got to find a way to get that kneecap back here in the center. It's pathological anatomy, but I've got to find a way from a carpenter standpoint, from a surgical standpoint to do that. So I know this is off base of the question you asked, but when I get into like my post surgical, my retirement plan would be woodworking, I guess.
It's funny you should say that. You know, I've never dabbled in woodworking, but in my first house, I finished my basement. Now I put all the studs up. I hang the drywall, but
I hate that part. I like to finish stuff.
But I liked doing that, you know. And then even at the house that we're in, my brother and I, we helped with each other's projects at our houses, gutted our bathrooms and kind of rebuilt them. And I've said to my wife, I said I would like to make furniture for my kids. Don't know how. You watch some videos and all this. I think
you'd figure it out.
I think it's neat to make something. I agree with you. And if that's what I would hope I have the opportunity to do someday is just like my grandfather, and maybe this is where I get it. My grandfather made some furniture. He worked at one of the forge places in Erie, but he was handy and he did some good woodworking. As a matter of fact, there's a couple older dressers in my house or my brother's house where my grandfather made. I actually have a filing cabinet, a two drawer filing cabinet up in one of my bedrooms. My grandfather made it. And so that thing has to be 50 years old.
Wow. So that's special stuff right there. Yeah, like, absolutely. So both of my grandfathers were carpenters. One was a finished carpenter. One was a rough carpenter. The rough carpenter could do everything. He could plumb. He could do electric. Him and my other grandfather built our house that my parents still live in to this day in Townville. But I love like this room here. Like, this was my creation.
I love it.
Physically didn't do it with my own hands. I was going to, but like every last little detail has my thumbprint on it. Cause I was like, well, I want this board recessed just a little bit from that one. And I want to use so this was all wood from Liona Road out by my parents' house a barn that had collapsed.
It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
So my third and final.
Your final. Question. Yeah.
So, if you had to describe your wife in one word, what would it be and explain why?
One word. Ooh.
I'm not trying to make you veto anything. You
know? No, I'm not. I'm just trying to think of the word. I mean, there's a lot of words that I'm gonna list a bunch of words, then I'm gonna land on one. All right. So she's extremely patient, she's extremely understanding, she's compassionate. She's empathetic. And she's loving. So those are five words. I would say my best interpretation of Karen Molly is she's understanding. And what I mean by that is, and all those other things come in underneath that, right? Like, she can be understandingly loving. She can be understandingly compassionate, empathetic. My wife will, no matter who she's talking to, try to understand where they're coming from. And it drives me nuts sometimes because I just want her to be like, just, you know me. You know where I'm coming from. Like, just support me because I'm your husband. And she sometimes will play this, and she gets this from her mom, and my mother-in-law, Mary, watches these. Love my mother-in-law, by the way. She plays this devil's advocate role. And it's really good for me because I've always been kind of this black and white guy, right? It's right, it's wrong, it's this, it's that, it's up, it's down. And Karen's more of a shades of gray. And it will look at things from a different perspective that challenges me to think outside the box and understand that, like, Ryan, this is how you are perceiving this. This is not how reality is, or this is not how John is perceiving this. So don't think that the way that you are perceiving this is the reality of the situation. Like, you're probably making up a little bit of a story about what John really thinks of you. And I'm like, no, I'm confident. And then you have a conversation with John, and then John tells you, and you're like, yeah, Karen was probably right on this. So I would say it's the best word for me to describe her is understanding, because she is so open-minded, and she doesn't judge people ever. She meets them where they are. And like, for me, I say this all the time. I've said this many times on this podcast. My wife could probably be married to, if you took people, I'm just going to give an age range, 5 years older than her, 5 years younger than her. She could probably be compatible and probably be fairly happily married to 80 to 85% of those people. I could, same thing, 5 years older, 5 years younger, I could probably be successfully and happily married to 1% of those people. I'm hard to, like, I'm a hard match. She's amazing, and I got really lucky. Like, she understands me. She understands what makes me tick. The fact that I'm difficult, but she embraces that difficulty, because I put so much pressure on myself and on what I do, like my day job, that I don't want to say that it runs my life, because again, I have that balance, but she's helped me create that balance, and she's helped me. She's my beacon. She's my compass. She really helps me understand what's important at the end of the day.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Sounds like she's a saint.
To be married to me, she is. So shall we turn the tables?
Absolutely.
All right. So multiple siblings, four siblings,
yep.
Right? At what point did you, like, again, you have all these, like, my three older sisters are all teachers. My dad was a teacher. My aunts were teachers. My uncles were teachers. When did you decide, like, I wanted to become a banker, right? Because, again, that's not what you went to school for.
Right.
What was that influence? Was there a person?
So, no, there wasn't. So, growing up, my father in the had a manufacturing company, and he was go with numbers and fractions and decimals, and so I took a liking to math as I was growing up. And you said, you know, maybe you didn't have to study a lot. I had to study a lot, but math came easier to me, and I really liked dealing with numbers. When it came time for college, I was either thinking about going to Gannon University for mechanical engineering or going to St. Bonaventure University for accounting. And I can't say that I went for accounting over mechanical engineering. Quite honestly, if I'm honest, I went because I was going out of town. Now, my twin brother, Jerry, he had already committed to St. Bonaventure. He'll tell you, he followed me. And what's interesting is that my older siblings all went to Gannon and in Villa. So my sister Katie started in nursing. And at that time, Villa had the college, and she was out of Villa. My brother went to Gannon. My younger sister, my older sister, Peggy, she's the younger of the two, she also went to Gannon. And I remember my father, he would come in, I'd be going to bed at night, and he'd talk to me, and like, he wanted me to go to Gannon. He wanted both Jerry and me to go to Gannon. And he said, you know, you'd have the home cooked meals and all that stuff. And I don't know what it was, but we just said, you know, just wanted to go away and get that experience.
But you guys went together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you room together?
Yeah, we did for 2 years, and then we got singles, and we've always had the same group of friends, if you will, and what have you. To this day, we do, both in college and in high school. But
I did not know that you had a twin.
Yeah, so we're very, very close. And you know, growing up, he and I would have a side business. I worked for my father, and I want to be answering another potential question here, but I would work for my father through the family business, and we had a golf course that was a private place. But and then my brother and I, not to be a glutton for punishment, we started our own lawn care business. So
when was this? How old were you?
High school. Nice. You know, but so back to your question though, I wanted to do accounting and going to college. I was the type I needed to challenge myself if I got bored. Not to say I got bored with numbers and studies. I had to work for my grades, and quite honestly, my grades were okay. But I worked for everything that I got grade-wise in college. And so I come out with an accounting degree, and I'm going, all right, what am I going to do with this? You know, and kind of my thought process in college was, I felt that, well, if I have a management degree, I could do management. If I have a marketing, I could do marketing management. If I have finance, I could do finance, marketing, management. If I have accounting, I could do any one of those four. And accounting, I think, was what was going to best challenge me, and I loved it. And so I came back to Erie, and as a matter of fact, my brother Jerry started working at Zurn Industries maybe that summer or that fall. It's now Thanksgiving time, and I don't have a job yet. And he goes, hey, Zurn has to do inventory. Do you, we got account, we shut down. Do you, they bring in help to help? Would you want to do that and earn a few bucks? I said, absolutely. And so I was there for the Thanksgiving weekend. And Jerry's boss, I knew him. I went to school with his, grade school with his son. And he said, what's your degree? And I said, accounting. And he said to me, he goes, well, Mr. Fessler, who was very high up at Zurn Industries, he goes, he's on the board of Marquette. He goes, I think they're looking for a controller. And I had known Mr. Fessler. We knew his, I knew his daughter, Susie. You know, there's a their family of a family of 10.
Yeah.
Wonderful family.
Orthopedic surgeon Fessler, I'm assuming.
Exactly. Tom yes. Fessler. And we had gone to school with Susie. Susie was our age, and Susie is now my twin brother Jerry's wife. But in any event, sometimes it's not what you know, but it's who you know.
Yeah.
And so I had an opportunity to interview, and I became a controller of Marquette out of college. Back then, Marquette was a $200 million savings bank, savings and loan. And that's how I got my start in banking. Now, I was accounting, and I had a good friend. I was there for 2.5 years, and I had a good friend said, if you want to stay in banking, he goes, you want to go into commercial banking. And my first question was, what's commercial banking?
That's my question right now. I mean, I have an understanding a little bit, but
and so I had an opportunity to go to another bank. It was called Penn Bank at the time, and I became a credit analyst. Now I have an accounting degree, but a credit analyst, you get financial information. Like you give me business financials, we would sit there and dissect them and try to understand what's going on in your business. And so it goes back to dealing with numbers. And I tell people, I'm 40 years in banking, and the best 14 months of my career was 14 months as a credit analyst. And it served me well throughout my career, because you could give me a set of financial information, financial statements, and I could look at it. I won't say in 10 minutes, but I know if I want to bank with this company or not, but it was the best experience and the best training that I've ever had. And I had gone to Penn Bank because with the opportunity to go into commercial lending. So commercial banking, commercial lending is you have your retail lenders, you have your branch managers that, you needed a loan to buy your house and build your home. We have residential mortgages. You start a business, they need business loans, commercial mortgages. And so I was dealing on the commercial side of banking. So I went to be a credit analyst, with the understanding that I would have the opportunity to become a commercial lender. So 14 months as a credit analyst. And then ever since then, I became a commercial lender. I'll say the rest is history. I was fortunate throughout my career, but, then I became a team lead. In 2017, So after Penn Bank, I had gone to Mellon Bank, and I was at Mellon. Mellon was acquired by Citizens, and I was there for 22 years. And I was covering Ohio and Michigan, and then I was covering up into New York all the way into Albany. And in 2017, I'd still maintain relationship with some of the people at Marquette. And one gentleman, Lou Natale, he was there when I started back in 1985. And he was there when I rejoined in 2017. Wow. And my wife, Becky, and I were out and about one night, and we ran into Lou and his wife, Marcia, and said, hey, you know, Dave Slomsky, who started up the business banking group, might be thinking about retiring. I said, well, I says, let me know. I says, because the timing might be right that I could be in for due for a change, you
yeah.
know, and doing a lot of traveling and what have you. And my career at Citizens served me well, but to come run the business banking team at Marquette, seemed like a great opportunity for me, and it was. I haven't looked back.
Wow. It's a great story. I love these origin stories and like how they intertwine, and the fact that you started at Marquette, went here, went there, then came back to Marquette. That's just like full circle. Yeah. So as with any job, as with any career, right, there's high points, there's low points, there's things we like, there's things we don't like. I tend to ask a lot of my guests this, like, what's the favorite part of your job that you do on a day-by-day basis? And it's a two-part question. And what's the least favorite part of your job that you do on a day-by-day basis?
You know, so I can answer that question is with the same, both those questions with the same answer. Dealing with people.
Dealing with people.
You know, one of the things that I love about my job throughout my career is being a numbers guy. I knew when I got the accounting degree, I didn't have the desire to say, I'm going to be a CPA. And I won't say sit behind a desk, because that's not what they do today.
Right.
You know, but back then that was my perception. And so what I loved about my job throughout my career is I got to work with numbers, but I got to work with people and businesses. And I think everybody would be surprised with what is made right here in Erie, Pennsylvania, and the great things that small businesses do in Northwest Pennsylvania. And so I had the opportunity to do work with numbers, work with people, the business owners, and see their creativity. You talk about woodworking and all that stuff, working with hands.
Yeah,
it's amazing the talent that we have of business owners. And the people that they have working for them, and what they can do, and take a block of steel and turn it into something that's really, really meaningful. Things that you probably use in and on the operating table on a daily basis.
100%. Yeah.
As a matter of my father's business, I remember growing up, they made bolts that was for American Sterilizer, and it would be for operating tables.
Yeah.
You know, but so I love working with people. And you
also hate working with the people.
Yeah. But, you know, I'd say that the least favorite thing, so I've had the fortunate opportunity to be in banking for, well, since 1985, if you will, so 40 years.
Yeah. Right?
And banking was great then. And banking is still great, but it's different, you know. It's changed. The regulations, the regulatory requirements and all that stuff of what we have to do as a financial institution, people just don't understand. And that's not a dig against them. It's just that what we have to do to protect our clients from fraud and the demands continue to get stronger and stronger. You know, and 3 years ago or 2 years ago when we had the bank failures, all right, all of a sudden now we have the bank examiners coming in. And they're going to govern us and review us on standards based upon things that they just put in place 30 days prior, but they haven't made public because they're responding to what happened with those three bank failures. Their actions are right, but it's just all of a sudden now they're it's like writing you up for a procedure that you did, but you didn't comply because the guideline changed yesterday.
Yeah.
You didn't know about it, you know? But and so when I say the people thing is it's sometimes just one, the requirements, and then people. We have, you talked about your wife being understanding, you know, we have to help our people understand what we're dealing with, you know.
Right.
Well, people come in and fraud is so prevalent these days, and I apologize if I'm going off tangent, but
that's all right.
You know, somebody, and I had a conversation with an individual in the last 6 months, and he was coming in to withdraw some money, and the teller said, sorry, Dr. Molly, that's a lot of money. It's uncharacteristic. Why are you withdrawing that kind of money? And it may have been like $3,000, and it wasn't like $50,000 or $100,000.
Right.
And the individual was taken back by that. Well, it wasn't his nature, and we've had so many times where people are being defrauded. You know, here's another example share with you, but we had a client come in, and they had fraudsters on the phone, and they were telling them that Marquette was stealing from them, and they were duped out of $27,000. You know, and so we tried to go to the extra mile to help protect our clients. But so when I say, you know, dealing with people, sometimes there's bad people out there, and they can make things tough. But I like to focus on the good aspect of
yeah.
You know, and so I, hopefully that answered your question.
No, it did. My last business question is similar to what you asked me. And again, this is a very common question that I ask a lot of my guests. If you weren't in banking, right, what would John Dill do? I'm not talking retirement. I'm saying
very good question.
If you had to do your career over and you were told you cannot be in banking, what would you do?
Well, I think so I'm going to say this is going to be an easy question for me to answer, because when I was thinking about where to go for college, thinking mechanical engineering or accounting. And so I wouldn't mind building stuff and doing stuff with my hands. My brother and I were creative, doing a yard work. I was always doing something. You know, I wasn't just sitting there. You know,
right.
I wasn't that kid that you're going to find sitting there just reading all the time. I was always trying to do something. And but having grown up with my father and the family business that my grandfather started, I had developed an entrepreneurial spirit, and so I would have wanted to own my own company and do something. You might say, what? I don't know, but I get a lot of satisfaction out of making things, and I
are very similar in that fact.
I get a lot of satisfaction when I say helping people. You know, when I accepted this position of the president at Marquette, I had sent a thank you letter to the board of trustees, thanking them for the opportunity, but also reminding them that you know, I take my responsibility very seriously, and that I view this as that my family just grew by 160 people because I'm responsible for 160 people, and so whether it was in banking or if it was a manufacturing company, small businesses everywhere, they do great things. And I think a lot of people might say, I want to be in business for myself. But it's 7 days a week, 24/7.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of responsibility. And if you have 10 employees, you have 10 families you're taking care of. If you have 50 employees, you have 50 families that you're taking care of. And that's a challenge every day of the week. Small businesses, they ought to be commended throughout our country. I think our country has been built on small business. But I would have been, I'd love to have owned my own company.
So I told you before we started this that this is the first time I've ever done back-to-back podcasts, right? So before you, I have another podcast called Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions. It's a private practice podcast where it's a national thing. We get guests from all over the country and world, for that matter, that we talk about the importance of sustaining private practice and what it takes to do that, because it's difficult, right? 20% of physicians these days are now private practice, 80% are hospital employed. That number has shifted 80 degrees from what it used to be. But my guest, he is a very unique marketing individual for private practices. He does what's called, I want to think, I got to get the term correct, because I actually gave him a new term. He's like, I like it. it's like hyper-focused marketing, where like you look for your ideal patients and they can find them for you. But I said, hey, I've got another podcast after this. You know, I have a banker coming on. He's actually my business banker. He's the president. He goes, oh, that's great. He goes, local bank? I go, yeah, it's a local bank. He goes, local guy? I go, yeah, he's a local guy. He goes, do you love your banker and your bank? And I was like, that's an interesting question. I've never been asked that. And I said, well, I can tell you I love this bank more than I've ever loved any other bank that I've ever been, you know, associated with. And not to name names, but there's a bank that I've still to this day hold a card for since the day I was born. So 46 going on 47 years. But the service that I've had from you personally and Terry and your whole team at Marquette has been just leap years ahead of what I have experienced at other banks. And I don't know if it's the local piece, because you've worked at different banks, right? Like the things that you're able to do, your outlook, you just function differently than most bigger banks. And I was like, this, and you said you had your family grew by 160 people. I'm not one of those 160 people, but I feel like I gained one of those people that I really, really trust when I was introduced to you by Kurt Gramley in 2020. So I want to thank you for that.
Thank you very much for acknowledging that. And I appreciate that. And I'll share a couple stories. But, you know, I talked about how banking has changed from a regulatory standpoint. And when I think back in my early career, and I could call up a number of my former colleagues that were in banking many, many years ago, and they would talk about how fun banking was. It was really fun. It's still really fun. And what I could tell you about the difference between, I'll say, the big banks and Marquette is we keep it simple. I don't want to sound like a commercial, but we keep it really simple. And we're small enough that we could be nimble. We can do things real quickly. And it comes down to knowing your customer. And those five C's are cash flow, credit, collateral, character, and I had it. Credit, collateral, cash flow.
Character.
And I had the fifth one. I was thinking about it. Anyways, but I'll get to it. But just dealing.
No, I'm thinking.
Cash flow, collateral, credit. Character, and now I'm gonna be.
Well, it'll come to you. Yeah, it'll like in the next.
I'll call you at 3 a.m. We can fire up the things, but
I'll keep the lights on.
There you go. Thank you. But but our whole approach is, you know, we do everything really, really well. You know, we have good people. You talked about. I was thanking you or the complimenting you about the compliments.
Yeah, but it's a team, right?
You said it's a team. It's not what I do. It's the team. We have such great people, you know. And one of the words I like to use a lot is passion. And we have people who are passionate about
Amen.
What they do and the level of service that they give. And that's what we speak about. At Marquette, we talk about not customer service. We talk about customer care. I think if you care about something, you're going to approach it differently, you know.
Have you ever read the book Unreasonable Hospitality?
No, you had talked about that, and I want to do that. I want to get that.
Yeah, do that. I mean, everything you're talking about right now is you're explaining it to a T. And Will Gadara, the author of that book, just beautifully outlays. Obviously, it's a restaurant industry, but it works for banking. It works for healthcare. And what you are doing is unreasonable hospitality. You may just not know it, but.
And you know, we're not really doing it. I'm not asking anybody to do anything different. It's the old adage, treat somebody the way you want to be treated,
yeah.
You know? And we have the ability to do that. You know, I've been at the institution where I said, you know, but somebody calls about this. No, you can't do it. And I said, well, I know the person. Yeah, but our guidelines is that you can't do it, you know? And we try not to let that get in our way. And I'm a big believer. I says, tell the story, cover down, identify the risk, mitigate it, and let's move on, you know? And when you look at, we're a very sound financial institution from a tier one capital ratio rating, which might mean nothing to the audience.
It means nothing to me
either. But we're, if the minimum threshold is 6, we're not, the industry standard is 9 times, and we're twice the industry. We're better than any bank locally.
Wow.
And that includes all the big banks. We are that financially strong. And we're not, we do a lot of things right. And, but our ability to keep it simple, and that's been our motto, is keep it simple.
Another great book you need to read is called Small Giants. All right. And it's about, it's Marquette, it's Whole Health, it's what's big enough, but still small enough.
Right.
Right. And it has that maneuverability, that nimbleness that you speak of, because that's so important. And it relates in all fields, right? Like healthcare. Yeah. I've been in those big hospital employment situations where you got to go to a board meeting, it's got to get approved, that then goes to another board meeting 2 months down the road. It's kicking the can down the road. Whereas like Edgewood, Whole Health, we're like, okay, this doesn't make sense. This makes sense. I want to make this change to make it make sense for our patients. We're going to do it. And we just, you agree? You agree? Okay, cool. We're done. We're moving ahead.
You see it, you know, with Edgewood, you see it in your performance, you know, and you're a great, and you guys do great things, and you don't cut corners or whatever.
No.
But you just say, you know what, this is what we can do. You know, I use the expression, some organizations can't get out of their own way.
Yeah.
You know, and we try to eliminate that. And that's just it. We could look at it and say, this is what we want to do, and we can do it, and we can make it happen. And you talk about was it Little Giant or
Small Giants and Small Giant. Unreasonable Hospitality.
But you know, my biggest fear as we continue to grow as an organization is that we lose that personal touch, and we cannot. That's, I feel that's our identity, and that's our advantage.
Yeah, that's like, it's like you don't want to get too big, right?
No,
like, because you see those companies, and I've seen them, you've seen them, that all were like, wow, this is like a family owned company. It's great. It's beautiful. And then it gets to that point that it just changes.
Yep.
And it's just not the same anymore. It has the same name, has some same familiar faces, but the feel, the nature of the company is different.
Yep.
So, personal questions?
Sure.
So, you have 3 kids. You said 2 girls and a boy?
Yes.
Okay. So, what do you like to do with your kids? Like, what are your passions with them? Do you like to play golf? Do you like to travel?
You know, I'll say we spend time together because my kids, my daughter, Jess, she swam. Lauren was bowling. My son, Michael, was soccer and basketball. And I joked that I said, Michael says, the day that you get taller than me, I'm going to kick you out of the house. And I think I would have had to have done that like when he was a sophomore in high school, you know. But we talk about being family oriented and, we'll do a lot of stuff with our kids. You know, we've talked about parenting. You hear people say they want to be friends with their kids. Well, yeah, you want to be friends, but there's going to be a time for that later in life.
Yeah.
You got to be a parent.
I'm not in that phase right now.
And you got to be tough, you know? Yeah. And so my wife and I were good about, you know, she was probably the good cop and I was the bad cop, you know?
But, I know that role.
Anything that we did, just being with our kids, we did a lot with them, you know. And I'll joke because when we go on vacation, we still go on vacation with our kids. And our kids will say, oh, like we'll go to the Outer Banks or something. And they'll be telling their friends and they go, who are you going with? And she's, well, my parents. You're going with your parents? It's like, well, yeah, you know. And when we were growing up, there's a few families, close friends, and we all had kids around the same time. And instead of going out, we would get together at somebody's house, and the guys would, we'd order, like, let's say we're going to get pizza and wings or whatever the we're going to do. Says, hey, we're going to go get it. We'd go have a beer at the bar someplace. And then, you know, a 30-minute trip turned into 1 hour because we had to make a stop. But,
yeah,
you know, but the wives were home having drinks. The kids were happy as all get out because they're playing. They're just getting together. And so doing a lot of stuff with my family. And then that has carried to today. You know, I think back when my father, growing up and we had our grandchildren, he was around just for a few years before he passed. My kids were all born. And but he would say, hey, Patty, why don't we have the kids up for dinner on Sunday? You know, and my wife and I like doing that. We'll have the kids up. Yeah. And now that we have the grandkids, it's even that much more special. But I'll say being with my kids, you know, is the greatest thing.
Yeah, I can't wait. I mean, we're doing it right now, but and I'm not wishing my life away by any means, but like every stage of that life, just enjoying where you are at that moment, right? Whether it's going to sporting events, maybe eventually going to graduations, celebrating their career accomplishments, celebrating their families and their kids, grandkids. So I see it with my parents. My parents are fortunate enough to have 13 grandkids.
Oh, wow.
With all the four kids. So it's a big family.
You know, I remember people saying, you know, oh, how old are your kids? And I'd tell them whatever age they were at the time. Oh, that's a good age. And you know, I said to people, I said, I was fortunate, but they were all good ages.
Yeah.
For us, you know? You know, we had our challenges with our kids, you know, but they were good kids. I mean, my kids were saints compared to me growing up. You know, I loved every phase of their lives, you know. And earlier I said about, you know, you have to be a parent and then a friend.
Yeah.
We're friends now. They're adults. They're young adults.
Yeah.
And we just have wonderful time.
How old are your kids now?
So Jessica is 35. She's a New Year's Day baby, 1990. So she's 35. Mike will be 30. Michael's 34 today.
Oh, happy birthday, Michael.
Yeah, how about that, Mike? Happy birthday, bud. Da, 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 and,
say it's your birthday.
You can sing. I can. And Lauren, she's, Mike's 34. Lauren will be 32 next month.
Oh, wow. So,
and each of them are very happily married. And Michael and Lauren are in town with their spouses. And all three children have babies now. So Jess has Noah. He's 21 months. He'll be two in June. And my son Michael, he and his wife Sarah have Hazel. She's 3 months. And Caden, John Lauren said his middle name is John after me, which made me very proud. And he'll be 1 month tomorrow.
Wow. Great stuff, man.
It's wonderful. Very blessed. Very blessed.
So I like to travel. That's one of my big career passions. I love to see different cultures. I love to experience different foods, different regions. I love to do it with my wife. We've been doing it with our kids. We went to Italy 2 years, well, 3 years ago now, 2022. Last summer we went to Greece. It's experiencing the cultures, the foods, the stories, the histories. Do you like to travel or what do you like to do like with your wife? Like what is that? Like, I know what you like to do with your kids. What do you like to do with your wife?
You know, Becky wasn't, when we were first married. So I told you we had, the manufacturing business and then we had a golf course. It was a private 6-hole golf course. It is now the public course, Fox Run Golf Course. I don't know if you ever played the 9.
Heard it. I've never played it, but.
And back then Becky would, she started to learn how to play golf, and then we got into kids. And if Jess is 35 years old, Becky hasn't played golf in 36 years.
Wow.
You know? So, you know, Becky and I, we will travel well together in the car and all that stuff. We would do day trips and stuff like that. You know, we've gone to two of our favorite places, I would say, is going to the Outer Banks.
Do you have a certain place in the Outer Banks that you always go?
We've gone to Pine Island and Corolla, and there's four families that we've gone with over the years. And I remember the first time, well, first of all, this goes back to 2004 and are going to be our first experience at the Outer Banks. And people are going, oh, it's great. You'll love it. You'll love it. And I felt like I was the only person on earth that had not gone to the Outer Banks. And my biggest fear was, like, I said, what am I going to do? Nothing. I said, I can't sit there and do nothing. I don't do well just laying on the beach trying to get a tan.
Right.
I go, this is going to be hard for me. And but what I really found was that I unplugged. You know, I'd still stay connected with work. I'd probably answer emails, which I shouldn't have been doing. But, you know, I don't want to come back to a ton of emails.
Yeah,
you know?
That's never fun.
And so, but I always felt like, well, geez, if I tie in for an hour or whatever, I feel good, and then I can enjoy the rest of the day. But but I absolutely did nothing. You know, that's when I started reading books again, you know, and again, spending time with the kids, you know, whether we were every day, every time we go down there, there's one day where we build, I will say a sand sculpture. It's nothing creative, but we would typically try to do something with the word OBX and incorporate the year. Hmm. And that would be we take pictures of all the families. And it was usually my brother Jerry and me that talk about being the artsy one. We would have the ideas. He and I would do it with the kids. The other guys, they really didn't want to do it. They might help bring the sand and all that stuff.
Yeah.
That's not a dig against them. But Jerry and I just seemed to like doing that. And when I was talking about Jerry and I had a business or the lawn care business in high school, he and I worked really well together. Being twins, we wouldn't talk a lot, but we would know what each other's thinking. And so we didn't have to talk a lot, you know, but so we worked really well together. So there was always one day in the Outer Banks when we would build that sand sculpture. And then that
great.
Would be the basis for our photo, family photo for the Christmas for that year or whatever.
That's kind of a great tradition.
Yeah.
So, all right, my final personal question. You ready for this?
I hope so.
So if you could transport yourself to any kind of point in history to meet kind of one individual, but in one location, right? So it's a three-part question, right? Time and history. So I'll just give you an example. I want to meet Michael Jordan, but I want to meet him in ancient Rome at this particular location, like at the Colosseum. Who would you want to meet? Where would you want to meet him? And at what era would you want to meet this person? And what would you ask them?
So you're going to say this is a cop-out answer, but this is there's one person, and that's my grandpa Dill. I never had the opportunity to meet him. He died of a heart attack at his desk at work 6 months before I was born. So I never knew him, and my grandma Dill loved her, just absolutely loved her. She was that woman, you like shake her hand, and she's like, shake your hand, and it's like, I don't want to fish, you know, just tremendous individual. And
yeah.
So talking about going off to college, and my brother Jerry and I, we went down to say goodbye to grandma the night before we were leaving. And my grandmother lived on 4th between German and Holland, I think. French and Holland, and right across the street from St. Patrick's. And my grandmother was very big and active in St. Patrick's Church, as was my dad. And I remember going there, and my grandmother was a big house, and she lives there all by herself. And I can still see it to this day, and I almost get like emotional, but knocking on the door, and grandma answered, and I wanted to meet my grandfather then.
Oh.
So, but I'd want to meet my grandfather at work, because I think of my father, and my father had a knack. So they have a machine shop, they make all these little parts, and there'd be 15, 20 machines running, and he could say, hey, you know, number 7 down, it's not running, why is that? You know, he just had a knack, and he was really good at what he did. And I think he got that from my grandfather. And my grandfather did a great thing of, he started the business out of his garage, and then he bought a building, and he expanded his business. And then when he died unexpectedly, my grandmother inherited his half the business, because there was a gentleman that he was in partnership with. And then my dad and his brother, and his brother-in-law, because my dad had Dick Dill. My dad was Jack Dill. There's Dick Dill, and then there's Mary Dill. Mary Dill married Dick Allen. And so the three of them, Jack Dill, Dick Dill, and Dick Allen, took over the family business, and then they bought out the other partner, and then the rest is history. But not, and there's a picture in our family and at the shop of my grandfather holding a piece of paper, and Joe Plavkin, a local artist, had painted that of my grandfather. And he actually, what he did is he actually took a picture, a photograph of my grandfather, and then he did an artist rendering of it.
Oh,
and,
wow.
I think about that all the time, and I would want to meet Joe Dill at Perry Screw Machine in the peak of the business for him then. You know, what was interesting is that, you know, you talk about history, and I found an article, it must have been after my grandmother died, and my grandfather Joe was interviewed in the newspaper, and they were talking about, this is back in probably, had to be 59, 60, and they said, what's your threat? And he says, foreign competition. Dealing, you know, you're competing globally. He had that answer in 1960.
Wow.
You know, and so his mind, his mechanical mind, and then his business savvy, I'd love to sit down and have a conversation with him and say, what made you do this? Why did you do this? You know, and just to get to know him, because I think he was a tremendous, he sounded like a great guy, and I would love to meet him at the shop. Just, you know, with the machines in the background and just picking his brain.
It's kind of amazing how influential grandfathers can be. Like, my grandpa Molly was my best friend growing up. I had my buddies, right? But, like, my grandpa Molly was, like, he lived with us. Unfortunately, he developed Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So it was a really hard time. But my junior and senior years of high school, him and my grandmother lived in our basement. And now my parents have moved down to the basement. It's like the cycle of the Molly family. And my sister and her husband bought the house for my parents. But such precious years. I remember I'd go down and I'd work out in the basement. I'd be lifting weights and my grandfather would just come down and just be with me, right? Whether there was conversation or not. But he was an extremely intelligent man. A lot of people may not have thought that about him because he drove a school bus. He came from Italy when he was 19, never saw his family again, didn't have a college education, didn't, you know what I'm saying? It was just like one of those people that people would think, he's kind of he could do a lot of everything, but not really that educated. But to me, he was brilliant. And his work ethic was what was so impressionable to me. And that's like what gets me to this day. Like, you get a little emotional with that. Like, I get emotional with that. I never had the chance to meet my mother's father, Grandpa Burgess. My sisters had an opportunity to meet him, but he passed away before I was born. But, like, same thing. Everything I hear, amazing man. Just that's who we are, right? Like, it's in our blood. It's it helps shape our parents, which then helps shape us. So when you go back to, like, your question of me and then the boys, like, that's why it's so, like, precious to me, is like my parents helped shape me. Karen's parents helped shape her. Now we're helping shape our boys, and they're going to someday shape their children. And hopefully there's some of us that gets passed on through that, the good stuff, right? That we've taught them. So,
you know, you talk about work ethic, and I'm certain my grandfather had it, because he was in his 50s when he left a job and started a business. That's gutsy.
Yeah.
And
50s?
Yeah, because he died when he was 56 years old when he died in 1962.
Wow.
And he started the business in 1956.
Wow.
So it was, it was 50.
Hmm.
You know, and but you talk about
gutsy.
Work ethic. And, you know, that's the one thing that I learned from my father. And I'm surmising he learned it from his dad.
Yeah.
And, because, you know, unlike you that could excel at school, I had to work for my grades and all that stuff. But I've, you know, people have asked me, says, you know, what makes you tick? I said, well, I said, you know, I'm not the smartest person in the room, but I don't want you to outwork me. Yeah. You talked about that other doctor. You know, the doctor said,
I was the workhorse.
You're the workhorse, right?
Yeah.
And, but that motivated you. And so, like, I've heard so many times people say, oh, this individual's really smart. I don't care how smart they are. If they just sit there and do nothing, it means nothing.
Yeah. You know?
But, and so having that work ethic. And I tell my children, I says, when you're doing something, you're done with this, says, Dr. Molly, what else can I do next? I said, don't wait to be told what to do. Ask. And I said, you're going to be better than 95% of the people in this country because just having that great work ethic.
Yeah.
And it'll serve you well. And
it's a hard thing to teach to kids this day and age, too, because, I mean, we've gotten so dependent upon technology, whether it's phones or iPads or video games or this or that. I didn't have any of that growing up.
No.
And when I said, like, school came easy to me, it didn't mean that I didn't have a work ethic back then.
Oh.
Because, you know, I grew up on a farm, so we heated our house with wood. So we were out cutting wood every summer. Yeah. We had a farm. We had a beef farm. So we had to go out and do hay. We were putting fence posts up out there. We were shoveling cow manure in the winter times. We were bedding the cows down in the winter times. We were feeding the cows and bringing them water. And so you always want something that's a little bit better for your kids than what you had it. Yeah. But at the same time, you always are like, gosh, I wish they had a little bit of that to drive them a little bit more, because
you don't want to make it too easy for them.
Yeah.
You know, and I've used the expression, I said, you got to let them feel pain.
Yeah.
So they got to understand it. They got to work hard, you know, put some sweat into it, you know, just giving it to them. Then they don't appreciate the value of it. And, but, you know, making them work hard, you know, being tough on them. And I think my kids appreciate that, you know, they're all very successful in their own right, you know? And I think because, you know, just being tough on them and they're all very good workers, you know, and that's the one thing that I can give them the brains, you know,
yeah.
But a good work ethic and that'll serve you well.
Well, John, I want to thank you for coming on, taking the time out of your evening.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed this.
Yeah, it was easy too, wasn't it?
It was absolutely.
I mean, it's just a conversation. Easy. Forget about that camera.
I'm sitting
forget
here
about
in these comfortable chairs, you know.
Yeah. So, looking forward to the summer. We got to get out. We got to play some golf with Terry and Sean.
And we're gonna win again.
We got to kick some butt.
We're gonna kick some butt, and we'll have a nice cigar too.
Yeah. So. All the guests out there, John Dell, Marquette, the president, good buddy of mine, great guy. If you're looking for anything, how do they get in touch with you, John?
Well, we're just about everywhere, but if you go to our website, you'll see me. You can call me morning, noon, and night. You can call any one of our people morning, noon, and night, and we will answer the phone for you, and we'll be happy to work with you.
And I can second that. Just as a customer, I've worked with many, many banks over the years, business, personal, and John and his team have gone above and beyond. So I just want to thank John for his hospitality, for coming out tonight, being a guest, his friendship, his business savvy.
Really appreciate all of that you just said.
Yeah.
The friendship is wonderful.
Yeah, it's the relationships, right?
Absolutely.
That's the one thing as I get older, I took for granted younger. Right. It was this, that, but like relationships mean the most to me. So, hey guys, if you have anybody out there that you want to see as a guest on the show, just reach out. I would like to like the show, subscribe to the show, comment on the show, leave descriptions of who you'd like to have on this show. And just want to thank you for tuning in and we'll catch you next time. Have a great night.
In my knee. When that doctor asked me, son, how'd you
says, hey, Sawbones, I'm just carrying on an old family tradition. I want to know, Doc, Sawbones, I'm just carrying on an old family tradition. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tell me all about it, Doc.
As a disclaimer, this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content on this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice from any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of their healthcare professional from any such conditions.